It's Monday, February 3rd, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. It may well be argued that America's true state religion is sport, and its central act of worship is football. And that would explain why yesterday there was so much attention to Super Bowl 48. The game, of course, took place at the MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey, and it took place in the midst of cold weather, and it was a blowout. The Seattle Seahawks beating the Denver Broncos by a score of 43-8, even though the Broncos have been the favorites going into the game. One of the big things to realize about the Super Bowl is that it's not just about the game. As a matter of fact, the game is just the central act of a sacramental system that is put together in honor of sports that involves television advertising and all kinds of entertainment and, of course, all that goes on in the media and in the popular culture about football and, in particular, the National Football League. As The Economist of London made clear, the advertising for the Super Bowl broke all records. It was $4 million for 30 seconds. Now, just ponder that for a moment. From a worldview perspective, it is incredible that people were willing to spend $4 million, an incredible amount of money, for only 30 seconds of time to get the attention of the ears and the eyeballs of America in terms of those who were watching the Super Bowl game. They were trying to sell something. In other words, those with something to sell thought that the prime opportunity for selling it, what exceeded any other single opportunity in advertising, was the Super Bowl. And they were willing to part with $4 million for just 30 seconds of your time during the Super Bowl. That tells us something. It tells us that there is so much focal energy on this singular event that it is worth $4 million just to have 30 seconds in the hope that some people will still be watching their sets rather than taking a break from the game and will be so captivated by what is shown on that advertisement in that commercial that they will then buy the service or at least feel a better sense toward the one who is paying for the advertising. This is something that should have our attention because it tells us that our eyes and our ears are important to people. They are important to those trying to sell things in particular. Some people might just be trying to sell a message, but in the main, they're trying to sell products and services, and they believe that this is the way to get your attention. That should tell you something. As the Financial Times explains, with 164.1 million viewers for some portion of the game last year, that's Super Bowl 47, the Super Bowl is one of the world's most watched TV events and for advertisers, quote, the biggest bullhorn in the world, end quote. That was said by Brian Perkins, vice president at Anheuser-Busch. Last night, Anheuser-Busch advertised its product Budweiser with two 60-second spots. In other words, that's four 30-second spots. In other words, that's $16 million. Anheuser-Busch for Budweiser beer paid $16 million for 120 seconds to sell America on their product. And what did they use in order to sell their product? Well, one of the 60-second ads featured a puppy, and the other, the legendary Budweiser Clydesdale horses. In other words, animals sell. They thought that animals would have our attention for 60 seconds in order for them to sell their product. Meanwhile, another big issue related to the Super Bowl is gambling. Last year, Super Bowl 47, $100 million gambled in Las Vegas alone. As the New York Times reported, in Nevada, more bets are placed on the Super Bowl than any other sporting event. Last year, it was about $100 million. Of that, the books kept $7,206,460. If you're counting, that's a 7% take for the house. John Drape, writing for the New York Times, makes very clear, even though people betting on one team or the other may lose money, the house never loses. It's just a matter of how much the gamblers lose. But the most interesting conversation about the Super Bowl was found in the pages of the Washington Post. Chris Benneke and Arthur Remillard writing, is religion losing ground to sports? They make a very convincing case that it is. They write, American sports fans have forged imperishable bonds with the people, places, and moments that define their teams. You might even call this attachment religious. They say that would be, however, unfair. But not unfair to religion, unfair to sports. They write, quote, while teams and fans are building powerful, cohesive communities, think Red Sox Nation or the legions of University of Alabama faithful who greet one another with Roll Tide, churches are losing followers. According to a 2012 survey by researchers at the University of California at Berkeley and Duke University, 20% of Americans claim they have no religious preference, compared with an unaffiliated population of only 8% in 1990. Roughly two out of three Americans, the Pew Report in 2012 revealed, are under the impression that religion is losing influence in the country. But these authors aren't finished making their case. They then write this, sports are on the opposite trajectory. 50 years ago, just 3 in 10 Americans considered themselves sports fans. By 2012, that proportion exceeded 6 in 10. Tens of millions of U.S. viewers tuned into regular season NFL games last fall, with the most popular matchups attracting upwards of 30 million viewers. Nearly 3 million people watched the National Basketball Association's Christmas Day games. And for devotees of these and other sports, lifelong loyalty to a certain city and team is de rigueur. Once you choose a team, sports commentator Bill Simmons says, you're stuck with that team for the rest of your life. The Post article looks at some of the more obvious connections between religion and sport in modern America, and then we find this paragraph, quote, "But high-profile displays of piety belie a deeper reordering of spiritual priorities. Modern sports stadiums function much like great cathedrals once did, bringing communities together and focusing their collective energy. This summer, the Archdiocese of New York is expected to outline plans to close or merge some of its 368 parishes. 26 Catholic schools in the Archdiocese have ceased operations. By contrast, the city and the state of New Jersey spent hundreds of millions of dollars to build new baseball and football stadiums," end quote. Beneke and Rimmelard write a very interesting article in this essay in the Washington Post, and some of their points may be a bit overtort. In other words, they may be making some of their arguments somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but the main thrust of their article remains in full force. The ascendancy of sports in America came along with the secularization of the very same society. That's why, as they come to the end of their article, they write this, quote, "But when it comes to the passionate attachments that sustain interest and devotion, it's time to acknowledge that sports have gained the edge, and they show no sign of relinquishing the lead," end quote. I think the most significant part of this article is the statistical data demonstrating that the secularization of the culture and the fall off in church attendance came at almost exactly the same time that there was an explosion of interest in sport. This will come as a surprise to many Americans, especially younger Americans, who assume that Americans must always have been as sports fanatic as they are now. But that fanaticism is a relatively new development. As they document in this article, as recently as 30 years ago, many Americans didn't consider themselves sports fans to any considerable degree. That's changed a great deal now, and the witness to that is not only all the new stadiums and other sports facilities, but also the ubiquity of sports merchandise throughout the entire American culture. In contemporary America, it certainly should tell us something that many people advertise the fact that they don't know who their God is, but they do know who their team is. And even though they don't want to talk about religion, they wear their sport on their sleeve. Meanwhile, on another very pressing front, on Thursday of last week, there came yet another state decision, a court decision, on the issue of the rights of transgender persons. This time, the state was Maine. And this came after similar issues had emerged just in recent weeks, even in recent days, in other states. What we're looking at here is the incredible acceleration of the issue of transgender rights, not just a matter of acceleration over years, but acceleration over days. The latest issue comes in Maine, where, as the Guardian of London reports, school officials were found to have violated state anti-discrimination laws when they prevented a transgender fifth grader from using the girls' bathroom. The family of student Nicole Maines and the Maine Human Rights Commission sued in 2009 after school officials required this student to use a staff restroom. Jennifer Levy, director of the Boston-based Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders Transgender Rights Project, after the Maine Supreme Judicial Court handed down its decision, said, quote, "This is a momentous decision that marks a huge breakthrough for transgender young people." Just to make our way quickly to what actually happened in this decision, the Supreme Court of Maine ruled that school officials had violated the rights of a fifth grader who was born a boy but had identified, according to the press, since age 2 as a girl, when they did not let this student use the girls' bathroom, but rather to use a staff bathroom. They violated the student's constitutional rights. One of the very interesting things in the Guardian coverage, and the reason why I'm using that particular coverage to make this point, is that the Guardian points out that in this case, the state of Maine and its Supreme Court had to choose between two competing laws on the statute books of this state. One of them very clearly said that separate gender-assigned bathrooms must exist in the public schools of Maine. The other said that there can be no discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identification. The collision between those two laws is what the state Supreme Court in Maine had to adjudicate, and adjudicate it they did. And on Thursday, they handed down a decision saying that the school would have to recognize transgender persons for the gender with which they now associate and identify, and allow school facilities, including bathrooms, to be used according to the gender with which they identify. Now, as we've discussed, this is not only a collision, as in Maine, of two competing laws, found to be in this case contradictory, it's also the collision, even on just the liberal side, on the side of the sexual revolutionaries, of competing interests that are also in collision just on that side of the argument. In other words, you have the transgender movement and the larger gay rights movement saying that persons must be recognized as the gender with which they now identify, regardless of the gender with which they were born that was biologically assigned. And that is now supposed to be the way all right-thinking people must think about the issue. And the court decisions are certainly trending in that direction. And, of course, you not only have court decisions, you also have legislative action, such as took place in the state of California, where it was the legislature that decided this and the governor who signed it into law. But now, of course, in California, there are very well-organized efforts to reverse that law simply because even the school districts aren't certain how in the world they can comply with it. Here again, even as in Maine there were competing laws, there are competing interests. Interest one is the transgender student who says, you must recognize me as the gender with which I identify, regardless of where I was biologically assigned. On the other hand, you have the rights of students who do identify with the gender they were biologically assigned at birth, who do not want to share this kind of intimate space with someone who was born identified by the other gender. Just to put the issue as simply as it might carefully be put, in the case of this situation in Maine, you have girls who were girls as assigned at birth, who are now going to have to share bathroom and locker room facilities with someone who was assigned as a boy biologically at birth and still is physically a boy, who is now nonetheless legally recognized as a girl. And that's a problem for many parents in Maine. It's a victory for the parents of the student who demanded these rights to be recognized and accused anyone who opposes this of bullying. But on the other hand, there are parents of girls who are saying it's bullying to them that they're going to have to share this intimate space with someone who is at least biologically still a boy. Of course, as many of these parents have made clear, even surgery doesn't change the fact that biologically this child was born as a boy. What we're looking at here is a form of organized cultural and social insanity. And this is where Christians have to think very quickly, because we have to look at this and recognize that there is extreme sympathy and concern that should be our first response to anyone who is so confused about the basic issue of gender that it would arise in this kind of public, very public way. On the other hand, we also have to recognize that the complete loss of sexual and gender sanity in a society will come at a tremendous cost. Not just a cost to the individuals, such as the students who will have to share intimate space in a very awkward way in the state of Maine and its schools because of this decision, but because the entire society is going to lose any way of actually speaking about humanity in the terms that humanity has always been referenced, as male and female, men and women, husbands and wives. The loss of that lexicon, the loss of that stable vocabulary, betrays the fact that there is a deep confusion that means, well, just consider this. How do you explain this to a 6-year-old? How do you explain this to a 6th grader? How do you explain this to a 16-year-old? How do you explain it to a 60-year-old? It doesn't get any better. The complexities of the actual cases might be better understood with maturity, but the basic impossibility of actually finding any stable way to discuss gender, and in this case, what it means to be a man and a woman, is completely lost. As I said, this issue of transgender rights seems to be gaining momentum not just day by day and week by week, but almost hour by hour. Evidence of that comes over the weekend, the very same weekend that came just after that Maine Supreme Court decision, when there was an issue that arose, as reported in the Raleigh News and Observer, as the Associated Press is talking about an issue in prison in Houston, Texas. Ramit Pollushnik Mashti, reporting for the Associated Press, takes us into a jail, a Texas jail, in Houston. The jail is the Harris County Jail. It's the third largest jail in the country. It processes 125,000 inmates per year. That's massive. As the reporter tells us, quote, black eyeliner rings Tanisha Stevens' large brown eyes. Her long dark hair is pulled back in a ponytail, and she excitedly shares pictures of herself in the blonde wig and skirt she dons when she's not in orange jail garb. Yet Stevens lives among men in a Texas jail where she, that's how it's written in the article, is serving a sentence for prostitution, and she knows she is nothing like them. Quote, I am feminine, a feminine person, a transgender woman, and some guys look at me, you know, with that eye. I feel very uncomfortable, end quote. The legal name of the inmate is Marcus, and yet the inmate identifies as Tanisha and is taking hormones, has been for 10 years, and is partly transformed into a woman, according to the article. The inmate is hopeful that soon the inmate can serve out time in a woman's jail, but now the inmate is in a men's prison, and the state of Texas honestly doesn't know what in the world to do. As the Associated Press reports, new rules say it is discriminatory as well as potentially unsafe to house people based on sexual orientation and gender. It turns out that this inmate is right now in a gay section of the prison, and according to the press article, it's a gay section of a men's prison in order to protect the people who are in there from being bullied and assaulted by the general inmate population. Now, however, there are those who are saying it's unfair and discriminatory to separate them on the basis of perceived or real sexual orientation, and yet those who are the advocates for homosexual inmates say it may expose them to grave danger to fail to discriminate at this point on the basis of sexual orientation. As the Associated Press reports, the new rules say it's discriminatory. So now the Texas prison hopes to house inmates based on where they will be safest and consider gender identity when making that decision. Well, do you see what's happening here? Immediately, they're admitting they're using gender identity, which is the very thing they were just told they couldn't use to discriminate. Now the state of Texas says we want to protect the people who need to be protected. But how in the world can they protect them if a higher court or a higher authority says they can't even treat them on a separate basis because of their perceived sexual identity or gender identity? Now, if you're following this discussion, I think you're doing better than the reporter in this article. Let me read to you the last paragraph. Quote, transgender women have to be eligible for women's housing. That's where they would be safest, said Harper Jean Tobin, director of policy for the Washington-based National Center for Transgender Equality. Final sentence, quote, these are women who are psychologically women, end quote. What that means and how that's supposed to function isn't clear, apparently, to this reporter, nor is it to virtually any reader. It simply points to the fact that when you embrace this kind of uncertainty, indeed moral insanity, there's no way even to make certain you even know what you're talking about. Finally, returning for just a moment to the issue of gambling, a very revealing article appeared in the Louisville Courier-Journal on Friday of last week. Sheldon Schaefer reports that almost $2 billion is spent each year in Kentucky on lottery tickets, parimutuel wagering, and at bingo halls, poker tournaments, and nonprofit raffles. And the state's cut of all that legal gambling is more than $200 million a year in paybacks, fees, and taxes. Well, that's amazing just in itself. $2 billion, the state's cut, $200 million a year. Remember when we were talking about the casinos in Las Vegas? The casino, the house never loses. Gamblers lose, the house never loses. The state of Kentucky is going to win. It won $200 million out of legalized gambling just in the Commonwealth of Kentucky last year. But a lot of its citizens lost a lot of money. And that means the state is intentionally benefiting by damage done to its own citizens. And that's not the only thing. It gets much worse. The perversity of this situation is this. The article by Sheldon Schaefer is actually about problem gambling. And there is the admission in this article that in the state of Kentucky, there are many problem gamblers. As a matter of fact, according to the article, the estimate is that the Commonwealth of Kentucky has about 9,000 addicted gamblers and nearly 200,000 other individuals at risk of developing a gambling addiction. Now, let's remember that the population of Kentucky is just over 4 million people. This means that 5 out of every 100 persons in the state of Kentucky, according to this estimation, is a potential gambling addict. That is a huge problem. If that were a pathology in any other moral or social area, the state would be declaring a moral emergency. But in this case, the state finds itself in a very interesting situation. Now, the article in the Courier-Journal, a very good article, includes this paragraph. Yet Kentucky has only 4 certified gambler counselors, and that according to Michael Stone, the executive director of the council that's concerned with this, that's the Kentucky Council on Problem Gambling. Kentucky should have at least 14 counselors, according to this article. So in other words, it's all just a matter of the number of counselors. The bigger issue, let's face it, is this. The state of Kentucky recognizes that it has a problem. 9,000, according to its own estimate, addicted gamblers in the state already, 200,000 at risk. But the state gained $200 million, and it needs more tax revenue. So the state of Kentucky is in the awkward and rather publicly exposed position of saying we need more revenue, so we need to get Kentuckians to gamble more money. But there are Kentuckians who are already addicted to gambling. This will mean that even more of those 200,000 judged to be at risk will become problem gamblers. But the state needs the money, and the state is the house. And remember what we said about Las Vegas. it holds true for any state that's in the gambling business. The House never loses. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. Remember, Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Call with your question in your voice at 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.